Thank you for that lovely introduction. It's absolutely fabulous to be here with you all. There's a really important bit about the introduction though that was incorrect. Not reverend. Very importantly, not reverend. not reverend at all. I'm very proud to have a lay vocation in the church. God has called me to be lay, and it is very important to me that I am a lay person. But where it's confusing is that my most recent job is I am Canon Chancellor of St Paul's Cathedral in London, the first ever layperson to be made a residentiary canon at an English cathedral. So it's confusing as it looks like I ought to be, and I spend my life going, no, not reverend, no, really not reverend. It's wonderful to be at this most exciting conference. As far as I'm aware, we don't have conferences like this in Britain. So when I was invited to speak here, I thought this would be absolutely wonderful to join with you and reflect together on issues that affect women, issues that affect women in academia. So what I'm going to do are two entirely different talks. So this morning is going to be the more academic, the more technical, and it's the right way round, really, isn't it? So while your brain cells have still some life in them, we're going to be jogging through some Hebrew words, some Greek words, some thoughts in Paul, philosophical concepts, that kind of thing. This afternoon, I'm going to be doing a much more reflective session on what happens when you try and write creatively as a woman in academia and what emerges out of that. So two very different kinds. So if you're finding this morning that you're not really relating it to it very well, there's another one looking completely different coming this afternoon. But this subject that I'm talking about this morning, embodiment in Paul, is something about which I feel really, really strongly. And I hope that I'll be able to communicate to you during the course of this morning why actually this is so important a subject for us all to be thinking about, but especially us all as women. There is something about being a woman and embodied which is very, very important, particularly in the world today. And I feel so strongly about this, not just because I am a woman, but I have two teenage girls, one of whom is 19, the other of whom is 15, who are right in the middle of a culture which believes bodies need to be beautiful. Let me just talk about that for a moment. We move on to the first slide. There we go. I only know the stats from Britain, but I suspect the stats in Australia are a similar kind of statistic. In the early 21st century in Britain, cosmetic surgery increased by 10 to 20% each year. So the next year it was 10 or 20% more than it was the previous year and then the next year after that. It's now increasing by over 30% a year. So each year, 30% more people have cosmetic surgery. Last year, worldwide, it's thought that around 15 million cosmetic surgery procedures took place, and that's not counting the non-invasive surgery, you know, injections and all those kinds of things. So in Britain, around 75,000 with around 50,000 non-surgical procedures. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not opposed to cosmetic surgery. My hair's dyed. You know, I engage with that. The question I have is, what does it communicate to us? What does it communicate to our children? That they expect that there is a beautiful body, that they must change their body in order to be considered beautiful. And when I was talking about this subject to a friend of mine who's a youth worker, she did a bit of work with some youth in London and surveyed 1,000 young girls about pictures of themselves. And she said, would you allow a picture of yourself to be put up anywhere public without it being photoshopped? 95% of them said no. So 95% of them wanted the picture of themselves to be changed to make themselves look different in some way in order for them to feel that it was okay for people to look at them. And that suggests to me that we're in a bit of a body crisis. That actually, if we cannot be confident that our bodies as they are given to us by God and are deemed to be beautiful because God has given to us this body, then we've got a problem. We've got a real problem. A slightly light-hearted thing for you now. Barbie. Good old Barbie. My girls loved Barbies. I did my best. I honestly tell you, I did my best for them not to love Barbies. And I completely failed. And they both of them adored Barbies. But what's really interesting is just looking at a physical Barbie. A Barbie, on the left-hand side is the Barbie doll as your daughters may have them. On the right-hand side is a Barbie doll as a normal woman would look like. And just see the kind of difference straight away. And if you extrapolated a Barbie doll into an actual woman, Barbie's neck is twice as long and 6 inches thinner than the average woman, which means that she wouldn't actually be able to hold her head up because the neck's not strong enough. Her waist would be 16 inches in diameter, which would be thinner than her head. And there would be only room for half a liver, one kidney, and not very much stomach. Her wrists would be 3.5 inches in diameter, and therefore simply wouldn't be able to pick anything up. They wouldn't be strong enough. And her legs would be 50% longer than her arms, which would mean that if she tried to walk, her back would break. So it's not only that Barbie is an unusual dimension, it would be impossible to be alive and have those dimensions. And that begins to get you into that sense of what we're projecting for young women. What they ought to look like is actually something they can't look like. And therefore, the beautiful body is something that cannot be achievable. They simply cannot function in that kind of way. And then I look around at the Christian church and say, don't we want to say something about this? Isn't this something that's really important for us to say something about? What do we want to say about what a beautiful body looks like? What does it feel like to be beautiful from a Christian theological perspective? And I think the thing that I found really difficult when I was writing my book on the body is the ringing silence that I found. In literature, in talks, in sermons, we simply apparently do not have anything to say as Christians on beautiful bodies. And I said, this has to be wrong. We have to be able to say something about what a beautiful body looks like. And that's why I started writing the book and why I thought it was really important. And the reason why I thought it was really important, which is something I will get onto in a moment, is there is something very, very odd that has happened to you. When you're in a scholarly world, and you will know it from your own scholarly worlds, there are bits that filter out of scholarly worlds and bits that don't filter out. So one of the things that may surprise you is that I only know of 2 New Testament scholars worldwide. There may be more, but I only know of 2 of them, and I've researched quite widely. So 2 New Testament scholars who don't think that Paul thinks the body is really important. All other New Testament scholars say the body is really important in Pauline theology. I wonder how often you've heard that in your churches. How often have you heard people preach and say, Paul thinks the body is vitally important to your spiritual well-being? Normally you just don't hear it at all because you hear something else. And I'm going to tell you what else you hear normally. And then I'm going to tell you why it's wrong. And that's where we're going this morning. But before we get there, I just want to talk to you also a little bit about kind of modern anthropology and modern attitudes towards bodies, because this is interesting too. Someone called Francis Crick is an English neuroscientist, and he's an atheist as well, and he says this: you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of identity and free will are in fact no more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. So basically what Francis Crick does is he does the opposite of what the Christian tradition says. So the Christian tradition says is that you are, your spirit, your soul is vitally important. Your body, not so much, but your soul and spirit really important. Francis Crick says you've only got your body. That's all there is. And actually anything that you might imagine about your body is entirely just kind of located there. What you feel like, who you are as a person, it's just your body. The reason why this is really important is that if you believe that your beautiful body is significant, and if you believe that all you've got is your body, then actually those become really important concepts for people to be able to deal with as they're thinking about who they are as people. So this is why this is important. So if we then turn into the Christian tradition, there's a... Sorry to draw attention to you, but there's a bit of space on the front row if you feel able to come. It's always the case on a Christian conference that there's always the space. I think that Jesus got his say, you know, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I always think that Jesus ought to have said, the first shall be last and the last shall sit on the front row. So welcome to the front row. So I want to move onwards now to the spirit. One of the things that, well, I have a little bit of a bête noire, and my little hobby horse is I don't like the word spirituality. And I don't like the word spirituality for a different reason than most other people don't like the word spirituality. There will be kind of three types of people in this room. There will be people who love the word spirituality. There will be people who don't like the word spirituality because it's kind of new agey and kind of airy-fairy and floaty. And there will be probably me, who doesn't like the word spirituality for another reason. And the reason why I don't like the word spirituality is that it implies that it is nothing to do with your body. In my glorious rule, when I have redefined the word spirituality to include our bodies, I'll be good with the word spirituality again. But the problem is that the word spirituality implies automatically to our minds that we're talking about something that has nothing to do with our bodies. A couple of definitions for you to illustrate what I mean. This is the dictionary.com definition, very similar to the Oxford English Dictionary. Spirituality is the quality or fact of being spiritual. Second one is the really important point that makes me very grumpy. Incorporeal or immaterial nature. That bit of you that is not your body, that's what spirituality is about. Have a look at another definition. This is from the Living Words of Wisdom. The definition of spirituality, if you go on to the... There we go. The definition of spirituality is that which relates to or affects the human spirit or soul as opposed to material or physical things. If I achieve nothing this morning other than one thing, what I hope you will go away from this morning is to go away with a clear idea that spirituality is not opposed to material or physical things. Spirituality includes your material, physical body, and that is the most important thing, I think, for what we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about embodiment and what beautiful bodies look like. So, let us now get on to Paul. A lot of people would say that the reason why we think what we think about spirituality is Paul. It's all Paul's fault. I hear this regularly on many occasions, actually about all sorts of things to do with Paul. Paul is responsible for a lot of woes in the world, if you listen to various people. It'll surprise you to know I don't agree with any of them. But the problem of Paul is that people assume that Paul works with a very simple understanding of the world, a dualism. So if we can go on to... So the idea that people have in their mind is that there are four concepts that work in Paul. There's body and flesh, and there's spirit and soul, and there is a big line between the two of them. So on the left-hand side of the line is the bad stuff, on the right-hand side of the line is the good stuff, and there is a big, big split between the two of them. In fact, one of the things that you will notice, and we'll kind of come on to this a little bit more later on, is that people assume that the word body and the word flesh in Paul, if you know your Greek, you will know the body is soma, flesh is sarx, and people assume that they're just interchangeable. He kind of goes, I need a word, which one? Oh, I'll go this one. Or I need a word, that one. He doesn't actually think differently about them. He does, but people assume this. And much more importantly, people assume that the word soul and the word spirit mean the same thing. Just listen, even if we're not talking about Paul, listen when people start talking about the spirit, they'll slip the word soul in, then they'll slip back to spirit, like it is exactly the same thing. In Paul, very importantly, it's not, and I'm going to show you why it's not in a bit. And the reason why we assume this is because we subsequent Christian tradition has influenced us into dualism. And you'll probably know what dualism is, but just in case you're not quite clear, dualism is that assumption that there are two things in the world, one governed by good, one governed by bad. And what you have is the things that are earthly are largely bad, the things that are heavenly are largely good. And if you know about dualism, you will probably know that it comes from Plato. Plato's philosophy has laid over a lot of Christian thinking in a very, very significant way, and it's affected the way in which we think about various things in the New Testament. Now, I like to say, if there's one thing you take away, I've now got another thing I want you to take away. The other thing I want you to take away is that Paul was in fact influenced by Greek philosophy. Of course he was. He grew up in Tarsus, which was the second biggest philosophical centre after Athens in the first century. But there is no evidence at all anywhere in Paul's writings that he was influenced by Plato. And this is really significant. He was influenced by other forms of philosophical thinking, but no evidence at all of Platonic thinking in his writing. And the thing is that we have, whether you knew it or not, you have an inner Plato. And your inner Plato, when you hear the word soul, tells you something about what it means. So every time you hear it, you make a definition about what it means. The problem is, Paul didn't have an inner Plato, and therefore when he uses the word, he uses it differently than we think he's using it, and that's really, really significant. So, your inner Plato will do various things, but kind of a very, very brief summary of it. In Platonic thinking, and it becomes even greater in Neoplatonism when you get the next phase of philosophical thinking after Plato, the soul gives life to the body, but unlike the body, the soul cannot die. So the really important thing about the soul for Plato is that is the life force. And interestingly, Plato thought that when your body died because your soul left your body, not because your body died and then your soul had to leave your body. If you see the distinction, the thing that makes you die is your soul moving on. And you will probably know that Plato believed in the transmigration of the soul. So the idea was that your soul was up in heaven. It's kind of a plug and play idea, I always think, Plato. So your soul's up in heaven, sees a body, down it goes, plugs into the body, gives it life. And at some point in that human being's life, the soul decides enough is enough, and off they go back to heaven. The body then dies. The soul then looks for another body, in it comes, gives it life, off it goes back into heaven. It's a very, very inadequate description of transmigration of the soul, but that's the kind of idea that you've got in Plato. The other really important idea that comes from Plato's understanding of the soul, and this really is significant for how a lot of people think about the soul today, is that the soul was what brought knowledge. That which brought, was kind of enlivened the body, also allowed you to think. And the reason why that's important in Plato and Platonic thinking is knowledge is what allowed you to know the divine, which we subsequently would call God. Plato wouldn't have called God in quite the same kind of way. So the idea is that the soul gives you reason. Reason allows you to have a relationship with God. Now this becomes very, very important in discussions about human beings and animals. So Plato and Aristotle would say animals have no souls. And animals have no souls because they can't comprehend the divine. They don't have reason. The difference between a human being and an animal is an animal can't have a soul. Human beings do have souls. The soul is what allows you to engage with God. Therefore, that's why animals don't have souls. Remember that because it becomes important when we look at the Old Testament. So, if we want to go on to the next slide. In my original presentation, I had a nice little natty bit of animation, which doesn't work on this slide, so you'll have to imagine my natty bit of animation, which is that the reality in Paul doesn't look like that. The reality in Paul is if you take the body and the soul, you kind of pull them together in the middle. So you have flesh, which is negative in Paul. The word sarx is 90% of the time used negatively in Paul. The word spirit is 100% of the time used positively in Paul. The word body is only ever used negatively when it's got a rider to tell you it's negative. Otherwise, it's not. And I would say about 90% of the time, Paul uses the word body positively. Very importantly, positive. And the kind of the clincher for me, the obvious overwhelming clincher, is that if Paul thought that bodies were bad, why would he want to describe the church as the body of Christ? It's an entirely illogical. But somehow it's kind of smuggled its way into our thinking that bodies are bad, but it's okay to be the body of Christ, otherwise not so good. Actually, for Paul, body is a really, really positive category that I hope you will be able to see as you do your reading through Paul. And as we'll see in a moment, soul is a very important category for understanding body in Paul. So, what we now need to do is a quick canter through the soul in the Bible so that I can communicate to you why the soul is not actually a Platonic soul in biblical thinking. And in fact, it's a really slightly complex thing because it requires you... So what you need to do now is take what you know about what the soul means, dump it out of your head, and I'll try and fill it with other things. So where we need to start is in Genesis 2. And part of the problem are our English translations. And this is where we hit a really interesting problem with English translations. Most of the English translators still function with an understanding of Platonic souls and therefore are trying to communicate something by the way in which they're doing their translation. When you realise that that's wrong to do, the English translations kind of fall apart on this particular subject. So, the first and most important thing to know is if you were going to translate a word as soul from the Old Testament, the Hebrew word you'd be looking for is nephesh. But notice, there's a space just here on the front row. And there's another space over here as well, again, also on the front row. So I'm just looking around to see if are we all right for spaces. So the Hebrew word nephesh is a very, very interesting one. And you wouldn't notice the way in which it's translated most of the time because it's translated really differently on different occasions, which I'm about to illustrate to you. So Genesis 2, verse 7. Then the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the neshma, the breath of life. And the man became a nephesh being. Can I just say that I'm really happy with the baby? Don't feel the need to go out. So the man became a nephesh being. You'll notice it's not translated as a soul man or whatever it might be translated as. The man became alive. Do you remember the thing I said, told you about Platonic thinking and how animals can't have souls? Look next at Genesis 9, verse 4. This is, Noah's just come out of the ark. God has said to Noah, for those of us who are carnivores, great news, you can now eat meat. Those of you who are vegetarians will tell me my theology is wrong there. But Noah comes out of the ark. God says you can eat meat only. You shall not eat flesh with its nephesh, that is, its blood. Two really important things to notice about that. The first is animals have nephesh, just as human beings have nephesh. I can't say that too often. As a result, in Hebrew thinking, animals, if you want to use the word soul, animals have souls. Unlike in Greek thinking, where animals can't have souls. Little cul-de-sac of a footnote. You know when children say to you, has my rabbit gone to heaven? Plato would say no, because your rabbit hasn't got a soul. What would Hebrew thinking say? So it's kind of a roller coaster of good and bad news. The good news is your rabbit does have nephesh, therefore does have a soul. But having a soul isn't what makes you go to heaven in Hebrew thinking. So, like I say, that's the roller coaster of good and bad news. And I'll leave it to you to decide what you say to your five-year-old who asks this particular question. But animals do have nephesh, which is really important in Hebrew thinking. Let's go on and have a look at a few other examples where we find the word nephesh in the Old Testament. God said, Genesis 1 verse 20, let the waters bring forth swarms of nephesh chaya. Again, animals with nephesh, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky. So you'll notice that one of the really key features of the word nephesh is it's that which makes you a living thing as opposed to a not living thing. That's kind of what it provides. And then Genesis 19 verse 19 I think is fascinating. Your servant has found favour with you, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my nephesh, which normally is translated as life. And then two more. Exodus 15 verse 9. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil, my nephesh shall have its fill of them. That's where you can see it suddenly kind of veers off into a completely different way of thinking. You couldn't really say, my soul shall have its fill of them. It would sound really odd. Not sure desire is the best translation, but you get the idea that actually what it's talking about is that, I think probably the best, if you wanted to go for one translation of the word, the best one would be life force. That which gives me life. So that which gives me life shall have its fill of them. You know, that kind of, that inner urge, that inner drive to life is, I think, what it's talking about. So then, of course, you do find the word soul in our English translations, but the problem is it confuses you because you haven't seen all the other uses of the word nephesh because it's hidden behind the words. So you'll find things like Psalm 30 verse 3, O Lord, you brought up my nephesh from Sheol, restored me to life from among those who had gone down to the pit. So again, you can see that probably life force might be the best translation, and that if you are in an absolutely dire situation, you would feel that your life force has gone from you. That which gives you life is gone, and God has restored that to you. So it's something in that area which I think is quite interesting. Now we need to move on to Paul. And what I want to persuade you, I hope, you don't have to agree with me, but I hope I will persuade you, is that actually Paul, in this instance, is more of a Hebrew thinker than he is of a Greek thinker. And he uses the word psuche, the Greek word that we would... So if Plato were using the word soul, he would have used the word psuche. When Paul uses the word psuche, I think he uses it far more like a Hebrew thinker would have used it than like a Greek thinker would have used it. So we start with Romans 2 verse 9. And when we've got more time, and there are fewer people in the room, I like to play the game of showing you a verse from Paul and getting you to guess which the word psuche is, because it's not as easy as you might think. So imagine you're playing this game with me. Romans 2 verse 9. There will be anguish and distress for everyone who does evil, the Jew first and also the Greek. It's always the trickiest one for people when I don't show them where it is, because they go, is it Jew? No. Is it Greek? No. So actually what Paul does there in Romans 2 verse 9 is there will be anguish and distress for every psuche. So can you see how similar that is to the use of the word nephesh for everyone who lives? Can I just say, very welcome to take pictures of the slides, but I've also made them available. So if you would like the presentation later, there will be a means of making them available. I'm looking at Diane. She will tell you how to do it. Colossians 3 verse 23 is another really, really interesting one. Whatever your task, put yourself into it as done for the Lord and not for your masters. The Greek says, whatever your task, put your psuche into it. Again, can you get that sense that it's your life force, the thing that makes you who you are? It's not necessarily your soul. So, what we can conclude from Paul, if I had longer to show you, I'd show you a whole load of other uses. Actually, it wouldn't have taken me all that long, because Paul only uses the word psuche 13 times. So if you think about psuche being important in Paul, it's not that important. He uses it 13 times. If you're bored one day and want to have fun, have a look at your English translations and put soul into the search engine in the English, and then have a look at how often the word soul comes up in Paul in different English translations. And what's very interesting is different translations have soul appearing different numbers of times. So the King James Version has lots of soul. The English Standard Version has medium soul. NIV has hardly any soul. It's very, very interesting indeed. don't take that as a criticism of the NIV. I love the NIV. But it is just interesting to see how different translators render the word psuche in Paul. It's just fascinating to have a look at. So Paul appears to use the word psuche in a very similar way to nephesh in the Old Testament. And therefore, you simply cannot say that Paul uses psuche like a Platonic philosopher would. He simply doesn't. And the really crucial thing that you will have gathered from the word nephesh is that actually the word psuche includes your body. It's not separate from your body. So think about Genesis 9, that verse that I showed you earlier. Where is the nephesh? It's actually in the blood, God says. So actually it is a part of your body. It's not separate from your body at all. You cannot take... With Plato, you can go, that bit's body, that bit's soul, I can take the soul away, and the body is separate. You could not take the nephesh out of the body, because the nephesh is the body in Hebrew thinking. And that becomes really, really important for thinking about how we contemplate bodies in Paul. Souls are an integral part of our bodies in Paul. And that is very significant. So, what we now need to do is go back again and think about the other word, spirit. Because the other word, spirit, I think is equally important and significant and different. And this is the really significant thing. Hold in your mind, soul is a part of your body, spirit is different. So, there is a wonderful thing about the word spirit in the Bible, which many of you will know, is that it has a multidimensional meaning. And we always fall down because we want to say, which one is it? And the Hebrew thinkers would have said all of them. That you wouldn't be able to go with one or the other. So the key meanings, though there are others as well, are these three. The Hebrew word ruach. It is sometimes used to describe God's spirit. It's sometimes used to describe the wind. And it's sometimes used to describe breath. And like I say, we go, which one is it? And they'd have gone, all of them. And that's why we kind of struggle sometimes with our understanding of spirit in the Old Testament. You'll be aware of the Genesis 1 translation, which changes in different English translations, and in a fascinating way. So the King James has the Spirit of God brooded over the face of the waters. The NRSV has a wind swept over the face of the waters. And you want to go, well, which one is it? Both of them. And in Hebrew thinking, they would have thought that. And in order to be able to understand it, you need to understand kind of how they would see the world. So imagine, I can look out of the window, you can't do it quite so easily, but if you were looking out of the window, you would see a tree swaying in the breeze. And if you were a Hebrew thinker, you would say, that's ruach. And you wouldn't say, is it God's spirit or is it the wind? Because the answer will be, yes, it is. The wind is God's spirit and God's spirit is the wind. And you would then look at your body and go, well, what makes my body alive? Well, it's the breath that comes in and out. Is that the wind or is it God's spirit? Yes, it is. So what they understand is that they've got that kind of, the Hebrew thinking or the understanding is that God's spirit is what animates the world. That's why God's spirit was there at creation. What makes the world alive? God's spirit. What makes you alive? God's spirit. So therefore, there isn't a distinction to be made between all of them. If you want to know what I mean, have a look at Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel 37 is where this becomes clearest in the Old Testament, where you have the word ruach all the way through. Again, you can't see it necessarily quite as easily as you would if you were reading the Hebrew. So Ezekiel 37 verse 1. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out in the ruach of the Lord. So Ezekiel gets to the... So Ezekiel 37, dry bones. So you're kind of with me on the passage. And so the Spirit of the Lord gets into the valley of the dry bones. And then later on in Ezekiel 37 is that he's talking about the dry bones living, and he says, I will lay sinews on you and will cause flesh to come upon you and cover you with skin and put ruach in you and you shall live. So that which, the thing that makes the dry bones alive is the ruach, the spirit of God. Then we move on to Ezekiel 37 verse 9. Then he said to me, and I'm just going to do it in the Hebrew, not the whole thing, just the Ruach, in case you're worried. So you can see where it all comes. Then he said to me, prophesy to the Ruach. Prophesy, mortal, and say to the Ruach, thus says the Lord God, come from the four Ruachim, O Ruach, and then the verb for Ruach, upon these slain that they may live. So in order to be able to get the dry bones to live, Ezekiel is to call on the winds, which will give them the breath, which will cause the body to live. In that is your little nutshell of what Hebrew thinkers think about the Spirit. The Spirit is coming from God. It is entirely God's Spirit, but it is what makes dead things alive. So Dale Martin, who's a New Testament scholar, who's written really interestingly on the body in Corinth, says this. In the ancient world, the human body was not like a microcosm. It was a microcosm, a small version of the universe at large. And what he means by that is the wind that's out there is like the wind that's in here. And I use the word unadvisedly. We use the same term too. But it is that which is animating, that which brings things to life. So what you have then is a whole range of ideas about spirit. Can we just move on to the next slide? I don't want to run out of time. So spirit in the Old Testament, we can conclude, therefore, is very close in some instances to nephesh. So if you think about Genesis 2 verse 7, God breathed into Adam. Interestingly, doesn't use the word ruach there, uses the word neshma, but then Adam becomes a living being. So it's similar in some instances. The key difference is that God's ruach is of course closely connected to God, obviously. But ruach in the Old Testament is always connected to God. That's the really key thing. There are occasionally ruachs that are not God's spirits, and then they are identified as being very much not God's spirits. But most of the time, if you're ever in doubt and it hasn't told you, it's God's spirit in the Old Testament. The other interesting thing, however, in the Old Testament is that there is a difference between God's spirit and our spirit. And God's spirit falls in the Old Testament and goes away again. If you want to summarise the difference between spirit in the Old Testament and spirit after Pentecost, is that in the Old Testament, the spirit falls and then departs. In Pentecost, the Spirit falls and stays. And the reason why in Paul's thinking it's harder to differentiate between God's Spirit and our Spirit is that God's Spirit doesn't go away again. So then you've got that question of how our Spirit and God's Spirit relate to each other. Which sets us up beautifully for reading Romans 8. Because then you begin to understand that Romans 8 is functioning with exactly this same model. Now, another wrinkle of understanding all of this stuff in your English translation is that your English translators have made a decision about what is being talked about by whether they translate the word spirit with a capital S or a small s. You probably know this already. And they just decided. You don't have to agree with them. When you're reading Romans 8 in particular, you can always ask yourself the question, is this God's spirit, capital S, is it human spirit, small s? And it's not always clear. So let's just read it and you'll get the sense of it. But you are not in the flesh. So actually let me just do a tiny little explanation of flesh in Paul, because it is, I think, very interesting. Flesh in Paul is not innately evil. Flesh in Paul belongs to something that will pass away. When you find it in passages where he talks about it, it's mortal. It ends. And basically the summary of Paul's thinking about flesh is, why would you put your confidence in something that comes to an end when you could put your confidence in something that doesn't come to an end? That's basically what he's talking about. So whenever he uses flesh negatively, it dies. So why would you put everything that you've got into something that will end when actually you could put your faith in something that will never come to an end? That's the kind of, so Paul has a kind of, we technically New Testament scholars would say Paul doesn't have a dualism, he has a duality. And the duality is not good and evil, duality is that which will come to an end and that which won't come to an end. Stuff that's now, stuff that's eternal. And the important thing with Paul is that actually eternal starts now. So you can't just go now and then. It's now that comes to an end and now that won't come to an end is really how Paul's kind of difference works. So his flesh is, you are not in the flesh, because actually now you are in the realm that will last forever. That's the kind of way in which his theology works. So you're not in the flesh, you're in the spirit. Since the Spirit of God dwells in you, anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. People who are systematic theologians don't like Romans 8. People who are systematic theologians actually don't like Paul a lot either, because unfortunately Paul hasn't gone technical by this point. Because a systematic theologian wants to go, is the Spirit of God the same as the Spirit of Christ or different than the Spirit of Christ? And Paul goes, don't worry about it, it's fine. But a systematic theologian wants to have a kind of more tied down detail than that. Anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. But if Christ is in you, though the body is dead because of sin, the spirit, largesse, smallesse, they've decided largesse, I could make a good case for it being smallesse in this instance, as in your spirit, is life because of righteousness. If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies also through his spirit that dwells in you. You can feel Ezekiel 37 kind of bubbling away underneath this. You can begin to see what Paul's talking about. The thing that gives you life is God's spirit. You do have a spirit that is your spirit, but the thing that really gives you life is God's spirit. We proceed on to the next bit of Romans 8, missing out a little bit. All who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you received a spirit of adoption. Jude will be talking about that later on. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is that spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. So what you've got there is Paul kind of playing with this whole spirit language. So there is spirit that is naturally mine. There is spirit that is naturally God's. The problem is that once you're in Christ, God's spirit comes and stays. So how do you tell the difference between God's spirit and my spirit? Well, you don't really, because actually they are both the same. They kind of start to blend together. And you will know that the really key thing about Paul's teaching in Romans 8 is that when we can't pray, God's spirit does it for us. It's almost as though God's spirit and our spirit kind of have a little conversation by themselves, even when we can't actually manage it. So there is something really significant for Paul about God's spirit and our spirit. And the reason why, I've actually got that one on the next slide. Let's carry on. Likewise, the spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we ought, but that spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. And God, who searches the heart, knows what is the mind of the spirit. Capital S or large S or small S, I'll leave it to you, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. He's the thing that is the communication factor. It gives us life and it communicates right to the heart of God, is what the Spirit is in Paul. So, what can we conclude, therefore, about Paul and the Spirit? It is contrasted with flesh, but then when you factor in that the Spirit is not immaterial, you've got to, so just like nephesh isn't immaterial, nephesh is in the blood, the wind, is the wind material or immaterial? Actually Paul would say material. It's a thing, it's out there. So the spirit isn't incorporeal. The spirit is a thing and you can find it in your body. So therefore you can't take the spirit out of your body, because still the spirit is what gives your body life. The spirit is that which comes from God. Flesh pulls away from God. Spirit pulls towards God. God's spirit dwells permanently with those who are in Christ, entwining with their spirit, and is the means by which they relate to God. So there you've got that kind of really, really important idea. The spirit gives life. The spirit communicates with God. The spirit kind of is that which allows you to communicate with God. And I think if you were to ask Paul, kind of to press him and say, what do you think about non-Christians and spirit? Of course, he wasn't... The problem we always have when people want to talk about Paul and non-Christians is, by definition, all of Paul's letters are written to Christians. So he's not telling us what he thinks about non-Christians, because that's not the point. The point is that he's talking and telling us what he thinks about Christians. And so therefore you've got to do a hypothetical. If Paul had been talking to non-Christians, what might he have said? And I think what he might have said is that he'd have said that everyone has the capacity to relate to God. They have a spirit, which is the means by which God's spirit can speak to them. So they have the opportunity. The question is whether God's spirit has fallen upon them and remains in them, as with Pentecost, as with the baptism of the Spirit. And that is what gives people the capacity to have a proper relationship with God. So everyone has the opportunity to. They don't necessarily have it because they haven't actually got that relationship with God's spirit. I think he might say, but you can disagree with me later if you want to. So then we need to move on to the interchange between soul and spirit in Paul. Where do we get? And this is where we get into really, really interesting territory. Fascinating. And where I get really, really grumpy about English translations. In case you haven't thought I've been grumpy enough already, this is where I get very, very grumpy. So, the top is the NRSV translation of 1 Corinthians 15. And I'll give you a little run into it in a moment so that you can understand what it's talking about. This is Paul's really crucial, really important description of what a resurrection body is going to be like. And it's so important in so, so many ways. And it's really badly translated in nearly all English translations, which means we miss the point. So the NRSV translated as, it is sown a physical body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man Adam became a living being. You'll notice, you know that quote, Genesis 2 verse 7. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. And people read 1 Corinthians 15 and then say to New Testament scholars, ha-ha, we've gotcha, because you said there wasn't a distinction between the physical body and the spiritual body, and here there clearly is. To which we go, well, if they'd translated it right, you wouldn't have said that. And it's a really interesting difference of translation. And so let me just show you, actually I told you I would give you a run in, let me just run you into it so you know what's going on here. This is that really amazing bit of 1 Corinthians 15 where Paul is saying, this is what your resurrection body is going to be like. And this is the other big clinching part of the argument about Paul and body. Because if Paul thought bodies were a really bad idea, then he wouldn't have said you're going to have a resurrection one. And this is where you get into the really, really fascinating stuff about life after death and Christian tradition. If you were to talk to the vast majority of people in your congregation, and I don't mind which congregation you're in, but in your congregation, 80% of them, 90% of them, 98% of them, name a figure, but a large number of them, would say, when I die, my spirit will go to heaven, or something in that region. People believe that it is the Christian understanding of life after death, that you live on in your spirit in heaven with God. We're not talking about resurrection today, so I can't kind of mine it as much as I would do. What Paul would say is that after death you will have a resurrection body. That's, I'm using the same word, soma. It's really, really important. So in 1 Corinthians 15, he's talking about what is that body going to be like. And you may remember that earlier on in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul has this person who says, and what will the resurrection body be like? And just when you're thinking, oh, that's quite a good question, he says, fool! And you're going, no, I wasn't going to ask that. I really wasn't going to ask that. Again, it's not a good translation, because the word fool actually means nonsense question. And what he means is, if you thought about the theology, you would know the answer and wouldn't need to ask the question, is what he really means, rather than just, you're very stupid. So, you must know that I love Paul, because I spend the entirety of my life thinking Paul's thoughts. He's a little harsh, so actually you might have said it as well. That's how the translation is normally rendered. But have a look at what the Greek actually says, because it becomes really, really interesting, I think. So what Paul actually says in the Greek is, it is sown. So our bodies now are sown a psuchikos body. If you were using Hebrew, you would say it's a nephesh body. It's sown a body that is made alive by psuche. It is raised a pneumaticos body, a body that is made alive by spirit. That's the difference. It's not a physical body versus a spiritual body. It's a body that's made alive by psuche versus a body that's made alive by spirit. Now, in fairness to English translators, you try putting that into English. It doesn't go. We haven't got the words for it. But you can see Paul's theology is really significant here. So what he's saying is, absolutely everything that is alive, human or animal, has a psuche. And we know that from Genesis, the nephesh. So anything that lives, lives with a nephesh, with a psuche. It's just the thing that makes the difference between you being alive and you being dead. In fact, there are interesting bits in the Hebrew Bible where they talk about dead bodies. And one way of describing a dead body is having a not nephesh body. The thing that is fascinating about bodies and dead bodies in the Old Testament is you've kind of got three gradations of bodies. So you've got alive bodies, you've got dead bodies, and those in the middle where they haven't quite decided yet which one you are. Because in the ancient world, how do you know? How do you know whether it's a live one or a dead one? They actually have a word for it, which is really interesting. You know, they're kind of, we're waiting to see which category is going to fall into this body. Think about the raising of Jairus' daughter. They don't use the Greek word there, but they could at that point. Jairus' daughter is in the middle category, and until Jesus comes along. So you've got kind of that kind of whole idea that bodies are nephesh bodies, psuche bodies. That's the thing that gives them their life force. That's the thing that makes them alive. But they're not really, really alive. What makes you really, really alive is the pneuma of God, the spirit of God. God's spirit in you is what makes you real. It's kind of supercharged life. You've got life force and total supercharged life. And the really important thing that Paul is talking about is come the resurrection, you won't have a psychikos body anymore. You will have a pneumatikos body, the supercharged alive body. What have you got now? Is a very interesting question. And I think that what Paul would say is what you've got now is both a psychikos and a pneumatikos body. We're in that kind of overlap of old and new creation, old time, new time. You have a body that is made alive with life force, your nephesh, but it is also made alive by the Spirit of God. And that's why he talks about the Spirit so much, is don't be focusing on the stuff that just makes you alive. What you want is that supercharged life force, life-giving. So notice how he retranslates Adam. The first man became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. See the difference? Adam's just alive. Jesus is life-generating. The Spirit is life-generating. And that's one of the things I love about kind of definitions of spirit in Paul. People often say to me, how do I know something is of the Spirit genuinely or not? And I say, well, Paul would say, does it generate life? If it's not generating life, it's not of the Spirit. If it is generating life, it is of the Spirit. It's kind of easy in Paul's thinking, at which point you want to go, yeah, it's not quite that easy. But actually, it's relatively straightforward in the sense that the Spirit, where the Spirit is, life springs forth. And we've all been there, haven't we? Where you've been in a situation and you go, there is life. That's a Spirit situation. You've also been probably in a situation where you go, it's not, but it appears to be, but it's not life-giving. And I just think it's a really helpful rule of thumb. Where is the Spirit? Where life is. If you're feeling dead and pulled down and lifeless, probably not of the Spirit. It's a very, very interesting kind of question to reflect on. So, let's end then with who are we? We are bodies that are made alive by the nephesh, that does come from God, but those in Christ are not just alive, they're indwelt by God's Spirit, which is life-giving. So you've got being alive, which is good enough, but being life-generating, life-giving. It is having the Spirit of God that allows you to commune with God, not reason. And this is something that I think is so, so important for us talking about pastoral care, for engaging with people. One of the things I became interested in when I was writing my book on the body is dementia. And actually, if you function with a Greek philosophical way of thinking, then someone with dementia is less of a person than they were before because they no longer have reason. They can no longer relate to God because their reason is no longer related to God. If you think Hebrew, then somebody with dementia is as much a human being as they always used to be, because they still have God's spirit in them and they still can relate to God. And if you've ever done any dementia care, one of the things that's absolutely beautiful is every now and then you see God's spirit radiating through them, and you can see it through song, you can see it through prayer. There was a lovely, lovely man in our church who was Welsh, and if you know about the Welsh, you know they love singing. And he got to the stage where he couldn't speak, couldn't recognise anyone, couldn't communicate, but if you walked into the room and started singing Bread of Heaven, he would join in straight away and his face would radiate. It was absolutely beautiful. We kind of just used to drop by to sing Bread of Heaven with him because it was so lovely. But that tells you something really important about human beings, about relationship, about God, which is that actually Greek philosophy gets us somewhere in our understanding about humanity, but we lose something, and we lose something important if we take out the Hebrew thinking. And so therefore, the final most important thing, and then I'll reflect a little bit on beautiful bodies, is that if we are of the Spirit, we are people who are living the resurrection body early. So Paul has this vision of what your resurrection body is going to be like, and he had a long list of things that it's going to be like. And my favourite bit is another bit you can't really put into English, which is when he's talking about it's sown a perishable body and raised an imperishable body. Actually, that's a bad translation. So the word for perishable is the word that kind of... So imagine a line, and here you're born and here you die. So you start at the front of the line and you kind of go along the line and you get older and older, and then things start to drop off and they stop working, and then you get to the end and you die. Cheery old story about life. Paul's word for imperishable, you cannot put into English because it goes back the opposite direction along the line. So how you put that into English is almost impossible. But it's a body that is more and more alive, a body that has more and more energy, a body that can relate in the world more and more well. And one of the things I always say to people about bodies, after Paul's theology, is that you have to learn to live in your body well now, because if you don't, you're stuffed for eternity. If you think you're getting rid of your body happily and can live a nice, gorgeous spiritual life, well, if Paul's wrong, you're good. If Paul's right, then you've got a problem. Because actually, we need to be embodied now, because we need to understand how to live an embodied life properly forever. And that's why it's really, really significant. So what is a beautiful body? I'm not going to give you too many answers, because in a way that's your answer now. But I hope you can see that Paul would say these are beautiful bodies. They are beautiful bodies because they are alive with nephesh, but they are even more beautiful bodies because they are life generated by the Spirit. The Spirit is what gives beauty to our bodies. And one of the things I want to find a way to communicate... Oh, my neck. There's not many conferences I could say that out loud. I've distracted myself completely now. Oh yes, I know what I want to say. So one of the things I really, really want to say is find a way for Christians to be confident about what we think beautiful bodies are. And we think beautiful bodies are bodies like we've got. They're beautiful because God's given them to us. But they're beautiful because they're alive in the Spirit. They are beautiful because God gives that life-giving Spirit to us. And our prayer life, our communication with God, that living, bathing in the life of the Spirit, that's what makes them beautiful. And if only we could find a way to voice that with our teenagers, with our young women in church. And I must say, not just women. I mean, I think the really interesting thing is that the body beautiful is beginning to hit the men's market as well. How do we say this confidently, gloriously, joyfully? Because I think it needs saying, and it needs saying urgently. And we all of us need to find a way to be able to communicate that. So that's enough from me for this morning. We've got time, I think. Yes, we've got... do we need to finish about 22 to get people to electives, do you think?
We've got until about 25 to.
25 to. Lovely, lovely. So we've got about 10 minutes, a little bit more. I'll try and put my necklace back on while you start thinking about your questions that you want to ask. I am absolutely fine with you disagreeing with me, with you kind of questioning things. Whatever you want to do, please do raise questions, make statements, make observations, and I shall enjoy the conversation. There we go. I was going to say, do you want to think about it? Clearly no. So you'll be thinking about it while we have the first question.
So stand up and speak loudly because we have a
microphone. And I'm just going to turn off the recording. So now you can say whatever you like.